Hello and welcome. It was a bad week for President Biden after an at times confused, incoherent live TV election debate against Donald Trump. Critics question his age, so too do some of his own party loyalists after what's been described as the worst presidential candidate performance in recent history. While Donald Trump sent fact-checkers into overdrive with several fictitious assertions of his own success. We'll talk about how much of a difference the TV debate made to voters.
And I'm going to continue to move until we get the total ban on the total initiative relative to what we're going to do with more Border Patrol and more asylum officers.
President Trump?
I really don't know what he said at the end of that sentence.
It's been a week that's seen the Kenyan parliament set ablaze by protesters railing against government plans for a finance bill. And in the attempted storming of the building, at least 20 people shot dead by security forces. Days later, President Ruto cancelled the bill. We'll look at why the group dubbed the Gen Z demonstrators and the TikTokers in tear gas are credited with overturning the planning law.
This is the voice of the young people of Kenya, and we are very proud that we've come out in large numbers, although they are tear gassing us, but we don't care.
And it's been a week that's seen WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange return to Australia, a free man after a plea deal with the US. It's been 14 years either in prison or in hiding at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. His lawyer called the deal a criminalisation of journalism. Washington says the data dump of classified information put lives at risk. So, a criminal or a hero? We'll discuss the developments with a journalist who gave Mr. Assange refuge at his home during the early troubles. Welcome to The World This Week. And with me from the International Press Corps tonight in the studio, we have Patrick Smith, editor of the Africa Report. Great to have you on the programme.
And you've Greetings.
Been at South Africa this week.
That's right, yeah. We started the week with a lot of optimism. There was going to be a grand new power-sharing government between the ANC and the centre-right Democratic Alliance. And the markets loved it. The rand was strengthening. The interest rates came down. The ratings agencies upgraded. And then by the end of the week, it all changed. And the DA was about to walk out of the talks. And Ramaphosa's best allies were saying, don't give them any concessions. Don't let them get their hands on those economic posts. So we now go into the weekend and Ramaphosa's under pressure to name his new government. But we don't know who's going to be in it and whether this vaunted government of national unity is going to hold together after all.
OK, a new political world in South Africa still unfolding.
Sure is.
Eric Randolph, who is the AFP culture editor, former Tehran editor as well. A notable week, elections going on.
Yes. So there's a big presidential election happening in Iran after the death of Ebrahim Raisi in a helicopter crash. I think what struck me the most this week is Iran is often criticized for very much controlling who gets to stand in the presidential election. Ultimately, it's the supreme leader who decides who the candidates are. But whenever I would criticize any regime officials for how that means there's a lack of democracy in the country, they would often point at, well, look at you in the West. Do you really have such a good selection of candidates by allowing it to be freely decided? And I think what we're going to talk about today in the US debate does make us wonder whether the American system in particular is much better at choosing candidates.
It's very prescient. It ties us in nicely. We're also going to go to the UK, bring in Vaughan Smith across the channel, who is journalist and founder of the Frontline Club. Great to have you on the programme. An old friend of Julian Assange in a prescient week for him too.
Very much for having me. It's been a wonderful time. I mean, his supporters, as you can imagine, are very pleased. But it's been 14 years. And it's about time. But I must say, I take my hat off to the Australian government for taking leadership and initiative in making this happen. And I just hope that I was worried to see Julian, though, because his health has been very poor and he looked overweight and his face was podgy. And so I'm worried about his health. And I hope we can find out a little bit more about that.
Great to have you. We're going to get on to the situation for Julian Assange coming up in the programme. We'll go to Hungary as well, bring in the BBC Central Europe correspondent Nick Thorpe. Nick, also a busy week for you, the European Big Jobs Summit. I must mention for you as well, because you spent 6 years on this new book. Tell us about your time in the Carpathians for Walking Europe's Last Wilderness.
Yes, great to be here as well. I don't know which to start with, but the Carpathians for me is a kind of a getaway from the daily politics here, which can be pretty intense, with Viktor Orban obviously hungry about to take over the presidency of the European Union. So an exciting time here. Also, just in the aftermath of a European election in which Mr. Orban appears to have a new challenger in the shape of Péter Magyar, an up-and-coming Hungarian opposition politician. So lots happening here, an interesting place to be at the moment.
Great to have you. And your pomegranate tree in the background too for lightness. OK, well, let's get started. Thursday night, US election debate night live, 90-minute head-to-head between President Biden, former President Trump, in a clash with new rules. No live audience. Microphones often muted to give both candidates clear, uninterrupted speaking time. A chance for President Biden to prove his critics wrong. To show he was mentally fit. Age ain't nothing but a number. It didn't go to plan. It started badly. In a
10-year period, making sure that we continue to strengthen our healthcare system, making sure that we're able to make every single solitary person eligible for what I've been able to do with dealing with everything we have to do with. Look, if we finally beat Medicare.
Thank you, President Biden. President Trump.
Well, he's right. He did beat Medicare. He beat it to death, and he's destroying Medicare.
Well, sentences that didn't make sense at times. Donald Trump on the attack, saying at one point, I didn't understand what he was saying. I don't think he did either. And several analysts describing it as an unmitigated disaster. His VP, his vice president, Kamala Harris, defending him. She said it was a slow start, but a strong finish. She said he's capable every day in the office. Well, there's no question about his efforts. Well, it wasn't a night for President Trump to gloat about either, though he did, retelling falsehoods about abortion, taxes, the environment. But Biden, in a stronger moment, didn't pull punches.
Think of all the civil penalties you have. How many billions of dollars do you owe in civil penalties for molesting a woman in public, for doing a whole range of things, of having sex with a porn star on the night while your wife was pregnant? I mean, what are you talking about? You have the morals of an alley cat.
I didn't have sex with a porn star.
Okay, there are so many areas to look at with this. We'll start with you, Eric. We need to talk about Joe. A bad night, his team saying he was just rusty. He's great. He's on form in the office.
I mean, there's bad, and then there's something so bad that I actually can barely watch it again. I've seen that first clip 3 times today, and it just gets worse with every viewing. I mean, it's almost impossible to come up with words that are too strong to describe it. You know, it's a train wreck. I heard the phrase goat rodeo, which I'd never even heard of before today.
What's a goat rodeo?
I think it's another way of saying car crash, dumpster fire, hot mess. I mean, it's so much worse than anything that we've ever seen before, I think. And if he was very far ahead in the polls, I still think this would be incredibly damaging to him. But the idea that it's neck and neck, or that he's even been slipping behind in most of the recent surveys, means that this, to me, looks impossible to recuperate from.
Mm. Patrick, a moment that the Democrats, as some of them are suggesting, should seriously think about changing candidates.
It does reflect very badly on the campaign. It was, you know, this was very much an own goal. They chose this debate. They chose the timing of this debate in June. They chose the format of the debate, where you had the split screen, so you could see Biden sort of apparently wandering off to la-la land as Trump was sort of spewing out the lies and the fibs. It just was unbelievable. They could have put that. I mean, this is meant to be one of the most professional campaign teams in the world. They are world beaters. These are the people who brought you Barack Obama, Clinton. I mean, that crowd, the, you know, Democratic Party's political nous is meant to be incredible. How they could have got into this mess. But I think the first mess started when Biden was meant to be a one-term president. And they didn't sit down with Jill Biden and say, look, this is great. He's done it. He's changed the dial. Now we need to focus on getting the strongest possible candidate who's going to carry on his legacy for a second term. The idea he should even have been set up, no matter how well things were going in the first term, to fight again at the age of 81, it was ludicrous. It was always going to be a disaster. And unfortunately, it's turned into the disaster. I don't know how they can really claw it back. The omens for Chicago, I was with some American friends last night, who were actually at the 68 Democrat convention with Mayor Daley, and where there was this fight over the Democratic nomination then, and that ended extremely badly. No one's suggesting we're going to sort of see fighting in the street necessarily, but it's going to be very, very bad and very, very bad and divisive for the party. So I think if they're going to make any chance of changing it, they're going to have to start right now. And it doesn't look like they're ready. I mean, they're walking around saying Biden, you know, started off a little weak, but ended so strong. I mean, no one believes that. No one agrees with it.
Yeah. Vaughan Smith in the UK, let me get your thought on this, because we're just listening there to Patrick talking about, you know, a disastrous night. If you think about it and step back from his supporters saying that he'd been in the tunnel, so he'd been holed up for 2 or 3 days, getting so much information, facts, figures, you know, grad grind, sort of Dickens style. Maybe it was just too much for him to process, because you could almost see in his head he was thinking of the next fact to say. What's your take on it?
Well, I think the very fact that we were told about all this preparation made it even more underwhelming. But it's also terrifying. And clearly, should Trump win the presidency, we could be looking at the end of democracy as we know it in the, you know, most strongest power in the world. So it's absolutely terrifying. So, you know, of course, the talk now is, can he be replaced? I mean, one prays that they have a backup plan. One prays that they have some sort of contingency, but it's terrifying that perhaps they don't. And we're all of us going to have to watch America fall into a sort of 1939 situation.
And yet, in the midst of this, Vaughan, we have not mentioned, or barely, Donald Trump yet, and this sort of sense of facts or turning into fiction and vice versa and saying what he wanted and no live fact-checking going on.
Well, part of the problem is Trump's temperament. I mean, he's accused of being narcissistic. Well, if you know about narcissistic people, one of their extraordinary skills is talking and distracting and projecting all sorts of misdemeanors on the other person, and it becomes a complete mess, and it leads to a sort of cult following, which is what he's got. So I think you need somebody incredibly strong. Who can actually manage to take on Trump and point out where he's lying, and it requires somebody clearly younger than President Biden.
Nick, one of the things that strikes me, so there've been TV debates here in France, in the UK ahead of elections, and some of the headlines have been talking about how is this the end of the TV debate, its relevance in a social media landscape. I think perhaps this tells us its importance, doesn't it?
Of the TV debate, I don't know. You know, in the run up to the European elections, here we had debates of the 9 lead candidates. They were rather disappointing. You know, it was sort of 11 talking heads, no debate at all. You know, I was, you know, as you all were, pretty shocked by watching that debate yesterday. I think, you know, the world, one has an impression sometimes as an ordinary citizen that the leadership of the world is that we're really missing, you know, strong statespeople. And when strong people do come up, you know, like Trump, then they're rather disappointing in office.
I think Patrick mentioned something key here as well, Eric, which was the clarity, the lucidity of previous candidates, rhetoric being important. That seemed to just disappear. And I wonder whether from both sides we have the rhetoric and, you know, as Vaughan suggested, of former President Trump, which was, you know, not being checked and becomes part of his personality. And we had just murmuring from President Biden. And I think if we look back to a few days ago, we had a UK election debate and one of the audience said, is this the best the UK can offer? Now, surely that's equally pertinent in the US right now.
Yes, I mean, it's fascinating that this is, these are the supposedly the two best candidates that could possibly be found out of 300 million Americans. But, you know, I think, you know, the problem is that debates are never really about policy. It's really part, I think somebody called it the political entertainment complex. And Trump actually did a very good job. You know, whatever you think of him, you have to give him credit for the fact that he had clearly been briefed on how to keep his mouth shut a little bit. He had come off very aggressive in their debates during the last election. And he now knows that he he very much saw immediately and wisely, actually, that if he just stayed back, took a step back, he would give Joe Biden enough rope to hang himself. And actually, nonetheless, he also gave Joe Biden tons of opportunities to push back against him. He talked an enormous amount about inflation and cost of living, which is the one thing that really does rile up Americans. And Biden could have very much hit him on Trump's key policy, which is tariffs on imports, which is going to drive prices even higher up. Biden was given tons of open goals with which to strike against him and missed every single one. And ultimately, this is a PR exercise. And you know, he had one job, which is, it's not just about doing the job of the presidency, it's about performing the job of the presidency. And that's what everybody wanted to see tonight, and that's what his party desperately wanted to see, and it's very much what they didn't get. Is it even possible for the Democrats to turn the tanker around?
Well, look, trending in the past few hours, Gavin Newsom, as top trend, also Kamala Harris being mentioned.
Well, people seem very unimpressed by Kamala Harris. I think the problem, you know, if the Democrats are serious that democracy is hanging in the balance and that Trump's presidency would be the end of democracy in the US, then they need to do absolutely everything in their power to turn the tank around and find a way out of this quagmire. And I think my fear is that it's just such a daunting task that they will ride it out, try and say that this was, you know, a poor night and let's move on, and it will, you know, will coast into a massive Trump victory in November.
Briefly, Vaughan, if you were in the Biden camp now, would you advise them to stick or switch?
It'd be my choice. I mean, he's extraordinarily good. But the thing is, he is perceived as being more left-wing. And that might be a problem. But also, there's a complexity of doing it, isn't it? I mean, there's no way. I mean, it's much easier to hand over to Kamala Harris, but that clearly she's got lower ratings than Biden. So they're in a jam. I mean, we're all in a jam.
We're all in a jam. It's nice to have a comma, and we'll see what happens at the second debate, whether it is indeed President Biden in September. On Tuesday morning, images emerged from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, showing part of the parliament building had been torched. Protesters had stormed the building. It sent MPs fleeing down a tunnel to escape. On the streets, police responded with force using live fire, tear gas. At least 20 people are now known to have died. The storming of parliament was a culmination of a storm that had been brewing since May, labelled the Gen Z demonstrations. The under-25s, angered by a plan for tax increases affecting the basics of everyday life, bread, nappies, sanitary towels, plastics, mobile phones. A movement grew without any obvious leader, a mobile generation of strangers organising themselves on WhatsApp, TikTokers getting tear gas, social media influences too, breaking down how the so-called finance bill would worsen the lives of those already struggling.
They are collecting taxes. We as the people of Kenya have no problem with paying taxes. But we want to see what the value of our money is doing. We will demonstrate you can't kill all of us. You can't abduct all of us.
Well, the bill was discussed and due to be discussed again on Tuesday. President Ruto, looking to make $2.7 billion in saving, initially dismissed the discontent. Quote, he called it cool kids and their clueless protest. The day after, he cancelled the bill.
I am very proud of our young people. They have stepped forward tribeless. They have stepped forward peaceful. And I want to tell them, we are going to engage them. We are going to have a conversation so that together we can build a greater nation.
Patrick, your reading of this week's events, what's at stake and ultimately what has been achieved?
Well, a lot is at stake, and a massive achievement for the Gen Z people who are better out on the streets, you know. They pushed Ruto to the wall at a huge cost to themselves, great bravery. I had friends who were in the capital that day. They said between 500,000 and 1 million people descended on the capital, and the shooting was going on all over the place. It wasn't just against the demonstrators who breached the parliamentary walls, but in the suburbs too. So the security forces fought back brutally, targeting and beating up and abducting young demonstrators. So the anger is extremely high, but the feeling of vindication and victory after Ruto, as you say, switched from a very hardline securitized response. He actually said, This is a criminalized protest. It's been hijacked by criminals who have treasonous intent. There was very little sympathy for by then, we all knew over 20 people had been killed, very little sympathy for them, and a kind of sort of vainglorious saluting of his security forces. You did the right thing. You restored law and order, and that's what we have to do. The next day, he turned 180 degrees, it is said, after getting a lot of promptings from outside, not least some of the Western embassies, the IMF, the World Bank, for all of whom are implicated in this, because at heart it's about living conditions. It's about the massive debt overhang that Kenya's built up, so that almost 70% of revenues are being spent on servicing creditors. And that's cutting into education and health and all the rest of it. That's why people are so angry. And last point I just wanted to make is, in terms of the significance, it's maybe too early to call this an African Spring, but the parallels with what happened in Tahrir Square in 2011 are pretty sharp. You know, you had the same sort of boisterous, rambunctious response from Hosni Mubarak. You know, you're traitors, you're trying to destabilize this country. I've got the people with me. We're going to uphold the institutions. Then the next day, completely changing around. I'm really sorry. I never knew things were so bad. We're going to make some concessions. Meanwhile, he's lost the people and he's lost some important elements in the military. So I think it's a very dangerous point for Ruto right now.
That is a really interesting parallel. I was there in 2011 right. In Tahrir Square in Egypt. One of the issues there was about the speed and spread of information on Twitter, how yep. people communicated, got together. No obvious leader in the crowd. When I tried to interview people, talk to any of us.
Right.
This situation here, unlike previous protests in Kenya, where you have had opposition figures, leaders, they're the ones to talk to. You've had TikTokers, YouTubers breaking down the finance bill, saying, look, you're going to have to pay 16% more for your bread, you're going to pay more for nappies, more for sanitary towels. That's clearly, how significant would you see that as a change in dynamic, the way that information is
spreading? Hugely important. They're really intelligent, the way they're using social media. You know, there's pictures on, Ruto has a Bulgari watch, right? And they've costed that watch. And they've costed how much that watch costs in terms of student fees, in terms of medicines for hospitals. They've costed the cost of his fleet of motor vehicles. And that you saw that the next day when he said, well, actually, we've had an office of the first lady, office of the second lady. We have an office of the third lady. We think that's a bit too extravagant. So we're going to end those offices. Already it's been pushed back. You know, I'm going to do something about corruption. I'm going to cut down all this extravagance. But it's too late. I mean, people saw this and you only reacted because people were in the streets losing their lives. So,
Eric, you're off to become the AFP's Nairobi correspondent next.
I am.
With Patrick talking about this parallel with an Arab Spring.
Yes.
What are your thoughts?
Very interesting parallel. I mean, the positive way to look at it, and you've touched on some of those points, is that Kenya is at a place where its young people feel in a position to take the country to the next step and to the next level. You know, they have enough freedom, enough political freedom, enough economic security relative to the rest of the continent, that they are demanding that they get rid of the last of those obstacles that are holding the country back. And actually, that's what's happening here. And these are not ethnically based or tribal protests. These are issue based. We want to be a modern, fully developed, fully democratic country. And we can see the key problems, corruption here, and here, and that need to be addressed. And the positive thing is that, yes, Ruto's initial reaction sounded very much like Hosni Mubarak, but it only took him 24 hours to turn around. Mm-hmm. And, okay, it seems like a bit of a big ask that he'll be able to genuinely deal with all the issues that the people are asking for, on top of all the economic challenges that they're facing. But, you know, Kenya, I think, of all the countries in Africa, seems to be in the best place to try and react. Whether or not they can realistically do that is...
Vaughan Smith, you have had a career, some audacious frontline wars, protests, tip of the spear situations. What's your take on what's going on in Nairobi right now?
I'm fascinated by this connection with the Arab Spring. But I'm also quite fearful. I also see some of the parallels with the way Russia was able to embarrass and promote information and use social media resistance in Russia. But I'm slightly concerned because social dissent of this sort hasn't been terribly successful for quite a while. And so I'll be intrigued and wish to follow to see how it develops and whether whether the demonstrators actually succeed in making change. And that would be my concern.
I want to mention one really eye-catching moment. This is when a CNN reporter this week was interviewing the half-sister of former President Barack Obama, who'd just been tear-gassed after demonstrating for the first time. This is the author and journalist Rita Oma Obama.
I'm here because look at what's happening. Young Kenyans are demonstrating for their rights. They're demonstrating with flags and banners. I can't even see anymore. They're being tear-gassed.
Patrick, the protesters today, in the last few days, saying that, yes, they've overturned it, but they're not going to stop. So right. Where is this heading?
Well, I think they're going to try and turn it into a rumbling campaign to keep the pressure up. Ruto has come back, as Eric said, with this offer of talks and negotiations. So they've got to then work out how they're going to play it, because they're not in any organized political parties or political groupings. Are they going to engage with Ruto, and on what terms? And is there going to be an independent investigation? 20 people lost their lives, at least 20 people. I've heard many more from responsible people, from MPs and others. Is there going to be an independent investigation into those killings, into the allegations of security force brutality, the abductions, for example? What about the people who've been abducted? That's an international dimension, because Kenya's just sent 500 policemen to restore order, help restore order in Haiti. And if your own security forces are being accused of wanton killing of peaceful demonstrators, where does that leave Haiti? So I think it's got a lot of implications. So I think the demonstrators are in an extremely strong position to demand serious concessions. The question is how they engage the Ruto government, on what terms and in what framework, and how it's monitored. But I would imagine that today they're thinking, right, we're on the up, so we mustn't lose our position of peaceful, effective, and target demonstrators. I mean, that's really, really important. They want to make sure that they're disciplined, they don't get hijacked by sort of third force operations, which, as Vaughan said, often happens in these sort of demos, where sort of some state-backed entity comes in, starts, teams up with agents provocateurs, and starts to sort of cause chaos. And that's what they've really got to guard against, I think, in the next few days.
Patrick, thank you. Well, a charter plane used by Taylor Swift earlier in the year to get her to Super Bowl was the focus of journalists and flight trackers all around the world Tuesday. On board was the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange on a journey from high-security prison in the UK to one of the most remote Mariana Islands in the Pacific to sign a plea deal with the US after 14 years either incarcerated in jail or in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. He pleaded guilty. The one charge, violating US espionage laws, and with that, he reboarded the plane, touched down on his home soil in Australia, a free man. No words to the press just yet. Stella Assange, his wife, mother of their three children, said adjusting would take a while.
Julian plans to swim in the ocean every day. He plans to sleep in a real bed. He plans to taste real food. And he plans to enjoy his freedom. Julian is the most principled man I know, and he will always defend human rights and speak out against injustice.
The end? Well, it seems after years of fighting US extradition attempts for leaking more than 700,000 sensitive classified documents that the State Department said put lives at US partners, allies, diplomats at severe risk. His supporters say he is a hero fighting for free speech, who exposed US wrongdoings, alleged war crimes in Iraq, and redefined data journalism. His critics, chiefly Washington, say he's an irresponsible activist, potentially endangered the lives of significant sources by unredacted leaking of material. Hero or criminal, journalist or activist? Let's start with Vaughan Smith of the Frontline Club. Let's remind us, back in 2010, you offered refuge to Julian after he was released on bail, accusations of sexual assault and rape in Sweden, which he denied and were eventually dropped. Let's begin with how you first got the news this week and your response to it.
He knocked on my door back in July 2010. I recognised him immediately because he'd been involved. The video you showed of the helicopter gunships who were shooting down and killed two Reuters correspondents. He had launched that in the United States. And so when he knocked on the Frontline Club door, he said he wanted a press conference on Monday. It was on a Friday. And so he got one. And I got to know him since then. And I saw a man and got to know a man who I thought was being presented dishonestly by the British and the American press quite a lot, but not exclusively, but also was subject to an enormous amount of misinformation, government-inspired misinformation, which probably cost taxpayers quite a lot of money. So I ended up taking him to court one day, and at the end of it, he had been given bail. Sorry, I am slightly shortening it. And his lawyers scurried around at the end of it saying, where are we going to give him an address? And I had a house in the countryside, and so I was sort of volunteered. And so he stayed with me for 13 months. I have been punished for it.
Well, interesting. James Ball, the new European now, he said this about Julian this week. He said, not breaking confidence to say, Julian was a difficult man to work with, but it was an incredibly energised, energetic time. He would talk of WikiLeaks at the time like it was a company of thousands of people, this huge leviathan. But the reality was, six or seven people, he said, volunteers working out of Vaughan Smith's front room in his beautiful country estate, he said, in Norfolk, and that you told your housekeeper the team were an unruly tech startup. Is that right?
Differently. He was one of that team and went on to be very critical. I saw different things in Julian. One of his judge appearances, he was described as a narcissist by the judge. But I saw somebody of empathy, somebody who gets up every day thinking that he was making a difference for us. And he had a remarkable ability to be interested in detail in other people's opinions. I didn't see him change his own very much. And I can see that he could be a difficult person to work with. But I think we should remember, he worked with journalists. He worked with five extremely well-reputed journalist organizations to redact his information. And it was only later when things started to fall apart
that he got frustrated. Let me also ask you this, because I've not been able to ask you while he was still in prison over the difficult details of his time and whether that would make him stay in longer. But one of the reports about him, while he was at the embassy, the Ecuadorian embassy in London, it backed off from Harrods. And there were reports for many years that he would dress up, disguise, and go into Harrods shopping. Do you know if that was true?
Very much doubt that. It would have been pretty difficult for him to get out. I don't think he left at all. It wasn't comfortable there. Well, it was comfortable at first because the Ecuadorians who gave him a sort of political asylum. Well, it was something slightly different called diplomatic asylum, which the British criminal authorities did not feel justified him breaking his bail. Then the Ecuadorian authorities changed and they were much less friendly. And I think it was pretty miserable then. And then he got yanked out and sent to Belmarsh on remand for 5 years in a prison for violent people. It was deeply unpleasant and it's good that he's been let out.
Yeah, it's a good point. The maximum security prison in the UK, Eric. Vaughan talks about the working he did with journalists. There were times where journalists would get very frustrated with him and he would get frustrated with the government because other newspapers were trying to get things clarified, redact things. And the main allegation put forward through Washington was that he was putting people at risk just by dumping stuff. How do you regard him as a free speech fighting journalist or a criminal? What's your take?
I think he's quite specific to a moment in time when the internet was still relatively young and the whole idea of citizen journalists that were going to take over from the traditional media were coming up. And actually, I don't think that this situation would come up again. I think the world was still learning at that point how best to use these new channels of communication and how, somebody like Assange would not have had that same outlet without the internet 10 years before him. And I think, if there were mistakes made during that process, then, you know, it's part of the learning that we were all doing about how we're going to deal with these new systems. I think the real danger with the Assange case, and to come back to my time in Iran, is that by doing this to Julian Assange, they made him a martyr. Whatever you think of him, whether what he did was right or wrong, there are cases on both sides, but he did become a martyr for free speech. And when I was in Iran more than once, when I would bring up cases about political prisoners in Iran, Julian Assange's name was put back to me as, oh, you think, as Western hypocrisy.
Nick, in Hungary, you and I have followed this for years as Europe correspondents for the BBC, checking data dumps by WikiLeaks involved information in so many countries, including Hungary, classified documents and thousands of cables leaked. What's your take on this, on him, and the way it's resolved itself?
Well, I think, you know, it's great news that he's now free. I think it was, as one of you there was saying at the end, that it was undermining the whole idea of the liberal West, really, that the persecution and imprisonment of Julian Assange and sort of ongoing legal difficulties that he faced. So that's one thing. You know, here in Hungary, in Eastern Europe, we have, you know, brave individual journalists, independent journalists, challenging often relatively authoritarian governments. For example, here in Hungary as well, we have campaigns by the government against individual journalists. So I think that people, whether they're in Kenya or in Eastern Europe or anywhere in the world, I think, as you're saying, you know, whatever Assange did, whatever one's sort of personal judgment on him, I think, you know, his release was a good day for free speech. And that affects, you know, all of us and all of us journalists trying to find out what governments are doing and holding them to account.
Patrick, did Julian Assange fundamentally change journalism? Because a couple of things that spring to mind. Suddenly you had collaborations between organisations that would never have collaborated. So you've got the New York Times and The Guardian. Mm-hmm. You have data journalism coming in. You have organisations like Bellingcat appearing. Right. This wasn't a thing before Julian Assange and WikiLeaks.
That's right. As Eric said, it was a technological and a journalistic editorial and an activist moment in time. All these things came together. And I think Julian Assange kind of melded them together, whether, you know, more, I guess, more activist than journalist to be realistic.
Well, he called himself both, how he felt at the time.
Yeah, activist or something. I mean, I think a lot of journalists had issues with this issue of protection of sources. You know, in a country like Iran or Afghanistan, yeah, a lot of people talk to Western officials for all sorts of reasons, not because they're sort of slavish supporters of CIA, just because they want to get stuff out to protect. So, you know, it would be appalling if people like that are put at risk. So that there was a mark against him. But on the mark for him, yes, he had the vision, he had the energy and the motivation to seize the technology and to really put the stuff out there. I mean, since then, we've had these sort of data dumps, these, you know, leaks on government officials around the world. And he started something. And I think just one other point about that, they could never hit him for defamation. They were never going to be able to launch a successful prosecution against him. So that rather reinforces the idea that he said, "Look, I'm banged up. I'm a political prisoner, because why not take the guy to court?" And what were the charges to do? You know, the rape case and all the rest of it. That's a different matter. But the substantive charge about not substantive in terms of his history, about leaking documents and official secrets and all that stuff, they couldn't lay a legal glove on him.
And Vaughan, knowing Julian, is that it now? He goes off a quiet life in Australia or not?
I'm as curious as you are, perhaps more so, actually. I think it'll take him a bit of time to regain his health. I mean, his young children have only ever met him in prison, and so he's got a bit of work to do on his family. Now, whether he writes a book or he becomes a university professor or he comes up with WikiLeaks version 2 or something, you know, 15 years on, I really don't know. But I'm going to be very curiously watching it. I mean, I'm sad that he's gone as far as Australia because I'm not sure I can afford the flight. I'd love to see him again, but we'll see.
Thank you, Vaughan. OK, well, that takes us to Thursday night here in Europe. Jobs night at the Justice Lipsis building in Brussels. EU leaders sorting out amongst themselves who takes the biggest roles to represent the union, chiefly the EU Commission President, with a €26,000 a month salary And with that, the biggest responsibility and power. No surprises here. Second term for Ursula von der Leyen. Her centre-right bloc came out on top in EU elections. Then comes the EU Council President, the socialist former Portuguese Prime Minister, António Costa, to replace the former Belgian Prime Minister, Charles Michel. And the Estonia leader, Kaja Kallas, to become the Foreign Affairs Chief. She's a liberal leader within President Macron's centrist political group in Europe. But not an entirely happy ship. One of the big winners of the European elections was Giorgia Meloni, Italy's Prime Minister. She said she was excluded from the talks and wanted more to say. After all, her group of hard-right nationalists came third overall in the elections, higher than President Macron's centrists.
La proposta formulata da...
I think the proposal formulated by the People's Party, socialists and liberals, was wrong in substance and method. On the merits, because it was not even vaguely anticipated by a discussion on what the mandate should be for those who hold these positions, following elections in which European citizens clearly asked for a new, different line for the European Union.
Chiaramente una linea nuova, diversa per l'Unione Europea.
And with Hungary about to take over the rotating presidency of the EU, the sixth monthly chance for each country to set out the agenda, Viktor Orbán's agenda, mega. Make Europe great again. Nick, sounds familiar. What's on the Hungarian agenda?
Yes, it does sound familiar, but I think behind that slogan, that very Trumpish slogan, make Europe great again, I think a lot of people across Europe will be surprised by a more constructive Hungarian position than perhaps we're used to. They've isolated seven key areas: European competitiveness, a more pro-farmer policy, migration, which is obviously always on Viktor Orban's mind, enlargement. Hungary, I think, will be pushing very hard for more enlargement, progress on enlargement for the Western Balkans in particular. It's interesting that in their 43-page document setting out the goals of their presidency, they don't even mention Moldova and Ukraine, though that's been very much on the mind of European leaders in the past months. But that said, I think on Ukraine, Hungary is going to be, it's sort of sorted out within NATO. It's effectively won a sort of opt-out clause from NATO's increasing coordinating role towards aid military support for Ukraine. That's why this led Viktor Orban, for example, to support Mark Rutte's candidacy as to talk about another big organization, as Secretary General of NATO, even though Mr. Orban had said only days before that he would never support Mark Rutte's candidacy for NATO. So I think we will have a more constructive NATO. This presidency for Hungary, it'll be an opportunity for Orban really to show that Hungary is a constructive player on the European stage, not so much, for once, not the black sheep of the European family, but one of the white sheep.
It's a very interesting point, because a few years ago I was at the EPP meeting in which the European People's Party on the centre-right, to which was pretty much the last one for the Hungarians before Viktor Orban was sent his packing orders. Now it sits within its own sort of group of different independence parties. There is talk of him getting together with kind of a super group, a super hard-right group with Marine Le Pen here in France. What are you hearing over there?
Yes, I think there had been a lot of hopes from Orban for this year about that. You know, he said, I think in a speech on the March 15th, that Hungary, not only Hungary, the far right, or he wouldn't use that phrase, national conservatives, he calls himself and others like him, would occupy Brussels this year. Obviously, that didn't quite happen. There was a strengthening of far right parties on the 9th of June. He's also spoken about Donald Trump. You know, he strongly supports Donald Trump winning in November in the United States. So instead of this sort of massive victory of the Orbanization of the EU, which is what he's been hoping for, something more sort of complicated has emerged. And I think he's having to, you know, I think he was sort of sailing into fifth or even sixth gear. And what we're seeing just in these last days as we build up to the EU presidency is Mr. Orban changing down into fourth gear, if you like. But he would probably, if he was taking part in this program, he'd probably say you can still go pretty fast in fourth gear.
Patrick and Eric, a brief word from you both on this. Does Giorgia Meloni, Viktor Orbán to a degree have a point that the EU elections fell not in the way of Macron's centrist party. They had a choice about who takes on the top jobs. Those on the right, the European Conservatives and Reformists, who came third, didn't. And that's therefore, they argue, not being reflective of a modern EU.
Yeah, someone got out the pocket calculator earlier in the week and worked out how they could do it. Because I mean, the way I'd been tracking von der Leyen's movement this year, all these joint visits with Meloni to Tunisia, North Africa, other destinations, banging hard the drum on, you know, dealing with migration, all the rest of it. It seemed to be the idea that she was going to rely on Meloni for the votes to get a second term as president. And then her problem then was Schulz and his Social Democrats said, no way, Jose, you know, we're not getting... You know, if you get in bed with the far right, we're not going to support you.
There's a cordon sanitaire.
And so presumably she's jumped the other side of the cordon sanitaire to the centrists, which I think tells its own story. How that's going to play on in the French elections on Sunday, if we're allowed to say that, God only knows. But I think they're going to get the centrists and the so-called moderates are going to get that thrown back at them. So, well, you only like democracy when it's convenient for you, and then you conspire against the will of the people in other occasions.
Eric, we have 10 seconds. I want to get your thought very briefly. Ursula von der Leyen, worth the money, second term. 10 seconds.
Well, I'd say it just makes, you know, the fact that Macron has thrown the whole of France into turmoil when actually the centrists and the neoliberals in Europe seem to have come out of this all right. It makes you wonder what Macron was thinking with calling a snap election on.
That wraps up nicely, and that sets the scene for Sunday. Thank you to my guests. Thank you to Eric Randolph, Patrick Smith, Vaughan Smith in the UK, Nick Thorpe too, my old colleague in Hungary. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for watching. We'll be back in 7 days' time for The World Next Week.